surgical palliative care may seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel. Hi, everyone. This is Red Hoffman. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Today, we will be discussing surgical ethics, and we'll focus particularly on the ethics surrounding do not resuscitate orders in the operating room. I'm joined today by three of my colleagues and friends, Dr. Sarah Scarlett, Dr. Pringle Miller, and Dr. Kim Kopecky. Sarah is a chief resident in general surgery at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She completed the ACS McLean Center Surgical Ethics Fellowship and is the co-editor of the most recent edition of the AMA Journal of Ethics, focused on the relationship between the surgeon and the anesthesiologist. Pringle is a general surgeon with additional board certification in hospice and palliative medicine. She also completed the fellowship in clinical medical ethics at the McLean Center. And Kim is a fourth-year general surgery resident at Stanford. She completed a fellowship in hospice and palliative medicine and another fellowship in clinical medical ethics at the McLean Center. Thank you all so much for joining me today.
It's great to be with you, Red.
Thanks,
you're welcome. It's great to have all you guys. As we're getting started, I'm wondering if all of you can weigh in on how you would define medical ethics. Pringle, we'll start with you.
I think that the way to define it is basically through the principles and the overarching tenet to do what is right for the individual patient. So that refers to autonomy, beneficence, justice, and malfeasance.
Sarah, would you add anything to that?
I think one of my favorite definitions of ethics I've heard and used is the pursuit of the good, and in medicine, applying the same.
Oh, that sounds great. And Kim, anything else to add?
I agree with both of them.
It's good to be in agreement. Thank you. So, Sarah, let's turn to you. I'm curious, what led you to pursue additional training in medical ethics, and how would you say this training changed you as both a surgeon and as a person?
I think the first time that I realized I was interested in ethics and wanted more training was actually when I was a second-year resident in surgery in our ICU. And I remember being up really late talking to one of my mentors, really weighing some of the big decisions that we had to make about our patients and feeling like, you know, there's the medical aspects of these patients' care, but then there's other things that weigh into our decision-making and just thinking about, you know, how people make decisions, why they make decisions, what are the guiding principles of those, and how to do the right thing. And I think that my interest early on in the ICU and also in palliative care really led me to ethics. I think that the fellowship that we all did together really added a lot to my career in medicine and just how I think about patients and issues. I'm really grateful for it.
So Pringle and Kim, I'm wondering if you could comment on why you chose to pursue training in both hospice and palliative medicine as well as ethics, and how these two fellowships complement one another, but how they were different from one another. Kim, you want to start?
Sure. For me, the palliative medicine year was largely clinical, whereas the ethics component of the training included a large non-clinical component. So we had a lot of education in law and education in kind of philosophy that supplemented our clinical coursework in ethics. And I think there's also a lot of interest, like Sarah, that I have in ethics that fall outside the realm of palliative care. And in the palliative medicine fellowship, you get trained in symptoms and goals of care and conversations and discussions. You get to think about difficult patient management, but you don't have as much time or dedication or training in the fundamental background of the ethical principles that Pringle already mentioned. And so for me, at least, it was an excellent complement.
What about you, Pringle?
Yeah, I would echo what both Sarah and Kimberly said. For me, I was interested in clinical medical ethics and ethics before I took on medicine. And that really had to do with, I think, the importance of self-determination. And so for, you know, we call that autonomy and ethics, and that's always been sort of a guiding principle for me in practicing surgery. The palliative piece came quite later for me and was an application of, to me, sort of the clinical aspects of practicing ethically, because in palliative we say patient-concordant care or patient-centered care, which again is a patient self-determination way of providing care. So it's all for me, I think, been very organic, and each piece of this coming together to provide the best care possible for patients within their particular circumstances and needs.
Pringle, I've heard you mention autonomy several times already. Would you say that is the most important when we're talking about medical ethics? Would you say that is the most important ethic?
I don't know if I would characterize one more important than the other, because obviously doing good and reducing harm and being fair and just are all very important as well. But I think it probably is the principle that's most aligned with self-determination, you know, honoring people's preferences for care and the right to refuse care if they choose not to embark on that journey. I'd be curious what Sarah and Kimberly think about that.
I don't think one of the principles is more important or more valid than the other. I definitely think to become a physician, to work your way through medical school, to get an MD degree, we think a lot about, like, first do no harm. And so non-maleficence is an easy go-to. And the same for justice. You become a physician because you think patients deserve equal care, at least usually. I mean, you usually think that. It's always true, but you know, a lot, like almost everyone who becomes a doctor thinks that no matter who you are, you have a right to getting medical care. And I think the trouble is in medical culture, and this has evolved and has historical roots that has changed and shifted, but in certain eras, doctors have made the decisions. In certain eras, patients have made the decisions. And really thinking about, like, who has the ethical right to make the decision, I think is where autonomy isn't so obvious as justice or non-maleficence, for instance. It just requires a little bit more contemplation, and it's much more clinical. Whereas, like, you hold justice in your behaviors, you hold non-maleficence as a physician in the behaviors that you don't do. Giving someone else the autonomy to make their own decisions is like a whole different ballgame. And sometimes it's scary when you're the doctor, but you have to come to terms with the fact that you don't get to make all the decisions about the patients.
That's a really good point, Kim. And maybe I would rephrase my question as not the most important ethic, but it's certainly the one. Autonomy is the one I feel like we speak about the most, but perhaps because it is the most clinically relevant.
Yeah, you wrestle with autonomy. And I don't, maybe there's a few physicians out there, but it's probably a rarer few that wrestle with first do no harm.
Anything to add, Sarah?
I mean, I think in America in particular, autonomy is so valued by our patients and by ourselves as well. And I think that there's always such an important onlay of thinking about that in medicine. I think that when most patients are thinking about the kind of care that they want or the decisions that they make, I think primarily they think about them being in charge. And I think we wrestle with that, like Kimberly said, a lot.
So I found that in some hospitals, it seems like the palliative care team is often called to weigh in on ethical dilemmas. I know this happens in my hospital. And I'm wondering if you can speak to why this may or may not be appropriate. particularly for Kim and Pringle, who have fellowship training in both of these?
Well, I think we have seen a real paradigm shift in how we manage ethical conflicts in the clinical workspace. And part of that just has to do with the fact that palliative is a relatively young specialty and ethics is not. So before we had palliative consultants, we had ethics consultants. And what I'm hearing from colleagues and seeing myself is that many of the conflicts that would have arisen in clinical care in past years, where an ethics consultant might have been called, a palliative consultant is called, and these conflicts can be often resolved with good communication skills and transparency of information and goals of care conversations. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that a lot of the conflicts that arise cannot be legitimately and well managed by palliative consultants. I don't know that it's inappropriate that palliative has become more prominent in these discussions and resolving conflict. I think that palliative consultants are pretty good about recognizing the limits of their expertise and engaging ethics consultants when they need to.
So, Sarah, let's talk about the latest issue of the AMA Journal of Ethics. I really appreciated that in the introduction to this issue, you wrote that modern surgical care is built upon a tridactic relationship between surgeons, anesthesiologists, and patients. I know as a surgeon that I've often struggled with the relationship, and I'm wondering if you could put that relationship into some historical context.
Thinking about surgeons and anesthesiologists and how we interact is important. And I think that the field of anesthesia would not be here today were it not for surgery. And now as things have evolved, we could not do our jobs without one another. I think that surgeons historically have held the belief that they are captains of the ship or in charge in the operating room. And while I think that in catastrophes and bad situations, it's important for someone to take charge and lead, but I also think it's important to share roles and share leadership and expertise in the operating room. And I really think that there's a switch and in perspective towards this. I don't know what the others think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think unfortunately in practice, sometimes tensions arise. I mean, I was thinking in preparation for this podcast that probably my most memorable disagreement, altercation with a colleague was in the context of wanting to operate on a patient who had a pre-existing DNR order, and the anesthesiologist flat out refused. And trying to unpack that was really difficult. So, you know, this topic, at least the perioperative DNR and the triangular relationship between anesthesia, surgery, and patients, I think is still a very hot topic as we grow and develop with our knowledge and our ability to assess really what's important to patients. And as our population ages and more patients will present older and potentially with advanced directives that include a DNR, this is a really good time to be having these conversations. And obviously this is coming up a lot for colleagues in the pandemic period as well.
And I think a lot of the ethical conflicts that arise in the operating room often relate to like whose responsibility is it to do what? To start a code, to call a code, to give drugs, to pursue surgery, to stop. And I think that a lot of conflicts can be explained or better understood by thinking about how we perceive each other, meaning surgeons and anesthesiologists, and how we interact. So I think that for me, this is a hugely interesting topic.
And when I think about palliative care in general, I think it's so much about relationships. And I think back to my surgical training, I think maybe I spent 2 weeks with anesthesiology. And when I think back, all I did was intubate people. I mean, that's what I did on the rotation. I didn't really spend any time thinking about what they are doing preoperatively, what they're doing really intraoperatively beyond intubating, obviously, what they're thinking about postoperatively. And so I never really, though I know a lot of them, I never really developed a great, I guess, professional relationship with them. I had more personal relationships with them because we spent a lot of time together and we joke around a lot, but I don't really feel like I was able to fully understand how they thought. And I think when we can understand how people think, we can really understand their motives and then perhaps have less judgment around what they're doing. I think we could all agree. We always say it's always anesthesia's fault, right? That's the default of the surgeon. And it's, we're joking around, but I think there's also some truth that we believe that. And so that kind of defines the relationship from the get-go.
In working on this issue and developing it with my colleague, who's an anesthesiology resident, I learned so much about what they do and the conversations they have with patients, how they think about patient care. It was super valuable to me. I think that before just my interactions with the anesthesia team, like in the operating room, it was also lost on me. I think they have a lot of important conversations and a lot of last conversations.
I was just going to piggyback on something that Sarah said regarding, you know, how we perceive each other's roles and responsibilities and what our domain is. And I want to thank Sarah and Patricia Dorr for putting this together, because I did gain a new kind of appreciation for the role of the anesthesiologist and how, you know, it's more understandable for me why there would be such a resistance to taking a patient to the operating room with the DNR order, given the fact that a lot of what they are responsible for is hemodynamic instability and ventilatory management. And when the idea of not providing those services enters into the whole perioperative paradigm, it's sort of cutting them off at their knees in some respects, you know, them not being able to do the job that they're there to do. And it's a little bit of an unfair ask on the one hand, but on the other hand, I think it's still possible to balance anesthesiologists doing the job that they're there to do and balancing that with the preferences of the patient.
Kim and Pringle, you wrote specifically about collaborative consideration of patients' resuscitation preferences. And before we really talk about the article you wrote, if we can first talk about what our professional societies have to say about do not resuscitate orders in the operating room. So both the American College of Surgeons and the American Society of Anesthesiologists, as well as the American Association of OR Nurses, have something to say. And can you all talk about what those societies say?
What I remember from reading the statements as Pringle and I worked together on the article is that they think patients should have a voice in their resuscitative preferences in the operating room. And that was at least my takeaway as we wrote it, and kind of the story that we tried to tell with our article is that all of the societies agree that patients need to be having a say in this, and that it is possible if you can come to some consensus on a case-by-case basis with the team that you're working with, that, for instance, offering surgery with a DNR order in place and what that means for that particular patient is something that at minimum should be a possibility.
One of the take homes from the statements also is that what is characteristically thought of as a automatic rescinding of a DNR for someone who's going to the operating room is not the way people should be thinking about DNR orders perioperatively. And that's why we wrote about required reconsideration, which is the ethical standard for having everybody discuss the goals and values and what's important to the patient and how a DNR may or may not align with that. But I think the overarching message with those three society statements is that it is not appropriate, it is not ethical to insist that a patient with a DNR order rescind their DNR order for the sake of having an operation.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times at how many different hospitals I've been told, well, this is policy, the DNR order is rescinded, and how I've been surprised how few surgeons and anesthesiologists actually know that that is not ethically appropriate and that their societies actually speak out against that.
exact experience a couple of years ago at a small community hospital where we work at. And I think one of the most important principles from the professional statements is a justice issue, which is that if there are members in the team who are unable for whatever reason, for their beliefs, to participate in surgery, and someone who chooses to remain DNR, then it's the obligation of the medical team to provide someone else who will. And I think that that's really an important piece. Like, while it is acceptable to step away if you aren't in agreement, there must be someone else who can fill your shoes. And that, for me, at the disagreement that I had, there wasn't another staff member, and this created a huge issue. But I think that that's an important thing to bring up in all of the policies.
I would say, too, that this is a good example of where autonomy eclipses the autonomy of the clinician who feels uncomfortable with that scenario, and the autonomy of the patient, and, you know, whose power and influence is really going to sort of prevail in a situation like that. And this is where autonomy, you know, is really pivotal, because it's really the patient's autonomy, I think, that we have to uphold. But we do have to be sensitive and consider that clinicians who feel like they have a moral obligation to do something that's not being requested don't have to suffer the moral injury of being forced to do something they fundamentally don't want to do, and need to be supported in their recusal of whatever their professional responsibility is, because they too have autonomy.
And I think it's really important here to bring up, like, the differences between surgeons and anesthesiologists and how they can play in here, because we are often lucky enough to have a relationship with our patients that we're bringing to the operating room, whereas the anesthesiologists don't. And I think it's up to us to have careful communication with them about who our patients are and what their beliefs are. And if we don't, then we can run into issues like I ran into.
Yeah, I think that something that's so important that I try to do is that if it comes up that we are going to go to the operating room and uphold a DNR order, then that is a time I always call the anesthesiologist and let them know. And I'd really like to be present for when the anesthesiologist is then having that conversation as well, because one, it's a difficult conversation to have for the patient and for the family, and to have the whole thing in detail twice is sometimes very overwhelming for people. So I really try to do my part and communicate with the anesthesiologist that this is what's coming, and give them a heads up so that we don't run into any sort of struggle, especially at the bedside.
One thing that I think that is a little bit tricky, and kind of just as surgeons and clinicians, you also have to watch out for, and I don't know how this fits into our whole discussion here quite exactly, but surgeons can make this decision unilaterally, and then the anesthesiologist, if they don't feel comfortable operating on a patient who has a DNR order, then nobody's ever going to hear about it. They're not going to get booked for surgery. A consent's not going to get signed, and that patient may have their autonomous decision to want surgery and remain DNR be totally unseen by the system. A surgeon first has to agree before it gets brought to an anesthesiologist, who then also has to be in this same space and agree kind of moving forward with whatever the plan is. I think there's a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a worry or a little bit of a bigger trap, but if I had to educate either, I would educate surgeons first, because I have seen surgeons refuse, and then it doesn't even get to be on the table anymore. And so we all have a duty, I think, to read our society statements and educate our colleagues, both in the community and in academic centers. But I think the onus of this, at least in some part, should fall harder or land harder on the shoulder of surgeons than anesthesiologists.
Well, that's a great point. Although I will ask, do you think there are any instances in which full surgical buy-in or the need to go to the operating room as a full code exist? Like, are there certain surgeries where upholding a DNR just seems inappropriate? I'm wondering if you all have thought about that from an ethical perspective.
Transplant.
Yeah.
I agree as well.
Yeah.
Pringle, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I mean, and the reason that you're saying that is because of a scarce resource.
You've signed up for a lot more than getting an organ.
And the benefit that somebody else might not be able to deprive if somebody were to, yeah, I think that that's a really good example. Can I just make a comment getting back to what Kimberly said regarding the first pass being surgeons? In our article, the data that we had access to demonstrated that more surgeons actually would be inclined to rescind a DNR than anesthesiologists. And so, you know, that not only are they the persons often with the relationship first and the persons that would be the ones to offer an operation, and then that, you know, that gets on the radar of the anesthesiologist. So that's just the workflow trajectory in general. It's also true that, as I said, surgeons have a higher incidence of requiring a rescinding of a DNR than the data suggests for anesthesiologists.
Which is really interesting because, as you said, a DNR in some ways, at least for the short term, is going to affect the anesthesiologist more than it is the surgeon, at least in the short term, right, in the operating room.
But I think that also relates to surgical buy-in.
The one other surgery that I think about is, of course, cardiac surgery, especially if you're going on pump. I mean, you can't not want to be resuscitated after. It just seems to kind of be part of the what you're signing up for.
An inherent part of the operation or very high risk, such as like incidents with arrhythmias and things like that.
Yeah. So the problem is that that's all very understandable. And I think that patients would also agree that if they've made the decision, or if their surrogate decision maker has made the decision to undergo an invasive intervention like that, they're not going to want to stand in the way of an outcome that's anticipated, a best case scenario outcome. But the problem is that these decisions don't get re-interrogated over time. And there's no precedence for having check-ins. There's no precedence for having check-ins at intervals of time when things might be changing, where outcomes don't look as promising as they once did. And so that's the Achilles heel of branding someone with a full code.
Do you mean those outcomes, looking at those outcomes like intraoperatively as the case is going on and things aren't going well? Or do you mean after the OR?
Yeah, no, I was really more speaking to doing everything possible that's required to get someone through their operation for what is considered to be going to be an outcome that's beneficial and improve somebody's quality of life. But we know that things often change in the perioperative period, especially for patients who are undergoing very high risk procedures and have comorbidities that are questionably going to compromise their overall outcome. So I was talking about really in the postoperative period that there isn't sufficient revisiting of the goals of care.
And I think this comes up a lot with perioperative code status, because while we all tend to agree that we should talk about it up front and we should make clear distinctions about our patients' preferences with required reconsideration, oftentimes people don't know when, you know, when is it okay to go back to the DNR, or when should we consider, when does this end? And I think this is where palliative care can really help us with time-limited trials and thinking about how to use those. But I think this is where a lot of clinicians struggle. You know, if you go to the OR and you rescind your DNR and then you go to the ICU afterwards, should you still have your DNR rescinded while you are resuscitated or cared for? I'm not sure anybody knows the answer, but I think that it's something we ought to think about and talk about up front.
That is something I really try to define with my patients and their families beforehand. And I really struggle with it because I don't know what the right answer is either. But it is something I really do try to bring up beforehand. And I was going to ask you guys, how do you define that perioperative period? Like, do you, any of you have a sense of how long that perioperative period lasts?
I think it's so dependent on the patient, how they're doing, and what their courses looks like. I don't know that you could truly define it broadly.
Well, it's also variable, right? Because there might be someone who flies and does well in a 2-week time frame, and then maybe we consider 6 weeks post-op for some of the other things that we make decisions about with regard to activity and post-ops and things like that, but that's then outpatient. But if somebody has a series of complications, what might have been a 2-week post-operative period could become a 2-month post-operative period. So this is what makes it difficult, is that each case is different and each set of clinicians and teams need to be mindful that there's not going to be a protocol for this. Each case is going to warrant these conversations at different intervals of time, depending on what layer of additional support is being added, which might take someone further away from their ultimate goal that they thought they were going to achieve before the operation.
I know for me, if someone's coming in with a do not resuscitate order, or, you know, a most form that at some, or a post form that at some time suggested they wouldn't really want any aggressive care, but they're willing to go, say, for emergency general surgery in the middle of the night, I tend to be pretty aggressive about suggesting that we put that do not resuscitate order back on pretty quickly, because they came with it for a certain reason. Like these people are coming because either they're, you know, say, I'm just thinking my elderly patients with multiple comorbidities who we know wouldn't do well in a code situation anyway. I have a low threshold to suggest that, okay, you want to do surgery, we'll take you to the OR, we'll see how you do. But that if your heart stops 24 hours after this, it might be time to just allow a natural death. And so it's interesting, Pringle, to hear you like talk about weeks for that perioperative period, when I'm thinking about how long to rescind the DNR for, because I tend to think in terms of hours or days.
Mm.
And I think that's forward thinking. And it's also dependent, like if you have somebody with a closed loop bowel obstruction, I would probably do the same. I would want to, if they came in with a DNR that they were willing or wanted to reverse for the operative period, in the immediate post-operative period, for all the reasons that you outlined, it makes sense for that situation. But if you have somebody with an open abdomen who's going back every 48 hours to the OR, you know, in the time between Abthera wound vac change 1 and Abthera wound vac change 2, I'm probably not going to resend the DNR for 24 hours at a time, on and off and on and off and on and off. And so it's definitely dependent on the clinical scenario, that's for sure. And the trouble is, we see it all. And so I think you just have to be cognizant of the patient's situation and their overarching goals, and at least have a discussion about what's important to you, right? If you're not going to be able to do X, then having a knowledge of the patient, or having family member that can give you knowledge of kind of the patient's minimum functional status, super helpful.
I'm wondering if you all can share some of your tips and tricks for navigating these difficult conversations with patients and families and anesthesiologists when we're coming upon this difference of opinion regarding the DNR order in the operating room.
Yeah, I think a go-to for me is often to approach a conversation with transparency of information of what is actually occurring and the severity of what is occurring and the potential options, but to also engage in a conversation around, you know, who this person is and what is their, what is important, like Kimberly said, you know, what's important to them, what makes up for them quality of life, and to frame a recommendation. And this is the American College of Surgeons statement on principles of palliative care. Fourth principle is that you want to frame a recommendation that aligns with the patient's goals. And so I will often say something like, I want to make sure that I do what is best for you, given your circumstance and given your preferences. And so in order for me to do that, I need to talk to you a little bit about what your expectations are and what I perceive to be the benefit of moving forward with whatever procedure it's going to be. And I generally find that patients and families are very appreciative of talking to them on their level instead of, you know, the sort of traditional paternalistic approach or surgical decision-making approach, where it's like, we can do this, we will do this, and not really thinking about the potential outcomes and how those might be devastating outcomes that confer more suffering.
And then any thought, Pringle, about how to deal with an anesthesiologist who may have a difference of opinion about bringing someone to the operating room with a DNR order in place?
Yeah, I think the same sort of approach is after talking to the patient or the family member who's the representative for the patient, this is what's important to them. This is what they're trying to achieve. And if they're not able to do well through surgery, and you know, obviously anesthesia's time frame within that scope of intervention is going to be the PACU most of the time, unless there's some other intervention like an epidural. But you know, to just express to them what their goals are and see what they think about that. I think approaching it from that perspective, a lot of anesthesiologists would want to comply with what's important to the patient, what the goals of the patient are. And as we talked about before, if a particular person feels like they can't do their job within that boundary, then they have the right to recuse themselves of the case. But bringing it back to how we're there to serve the patient's needs and how we're there to serve, you know, the outcome that the patients see for themselves, I think is a valuable trick.
I try to have these conversations with my patients as early as possible. I think that unfortunately, sometimes if we don't think carefully about this, it'll be left to the day of surgery in the pre-op area. And I think that's really inappropriate. And I try to, when possible, talk about this in the clinic, in a calm setting, sitting down and really talking to patients about how I take a pause before every surgery or before doing consent to really elicit goals and values. And talking about code status is just part of that. It can be uncomfortable and scary, but I think that I just encourage patients that it helps everyone know who they are and take better care of them.
And I think normalizing it too and saying that this is just what I do with every patient helps the patient and the family just feel like, oh, this is not just about me. This is just good, normal medical care.
Right. The same way that we talk about risks and benefits and alternatives and questions, we should incorporate code status and goals.
Kim, what about you?
I think more, I've been in the hospital recently on services that don't have as much clinic. So in the hospital, especially on like emergency general surgeries or acute care surgery type rotations, I always like to make sure that we're talking about operative and non-operative options. I think a lot of times we get called as surgeons, like the patient has a surgical problem and they need surgery now. The only thing that they need is surgery. And I think it takes a little bit of experience, but also forethought to say, like, just because the patient has a surgical problem doesn't mean they need a surgical solution. So I always like to make sure that if I'm having a discussion about high-risk surgery for a patient or kind of emergency-type surgery, that they're fully aware that there's other options that don't include surgical intervention, just so I can feel like I've had a fully informed discussion. And then I echo both what Pringle and Sarah said, kind of being upfront, honest. I don't like to talk about only the best case scenario. I think you have to paint a picture of either what you're expecting as like a realistic outcome, not the, and there's a 5% chance that all of this is going to go super swimmingly. That's a disservice to the patient. You have to talk about what's most likely and also what the potential worst case scenarios are. I like using Gretchen Schwarzi's tool, best case, worst case, because I'm also one of those people that likes to draw a lot of pictures for patients and kind of show with diagrams and to kind of like explain my decision-making, the way I'm thinking about their surgical problem so that they can understand it too.
Yeah. And one thing I've found with the anesthesiologist, if I'm running into maybe a difference of opinion, I don't know, Zara Cooper brought this up a while ago on the podcast about maintaining an attitude of curiosity about everything and just approaching it, not in an aggressive way, but really curious. Like, I'm just really curious why you are uncomfortable with this. So that, again, because I feel like I lack sometimes an understanding of the anesthesiology mind because I wasn't trained like that. And just trying to understand, tell me what you're most uncomfortable with so I can understand where you're coming from and that maybe we can meet in the middle. Because I do believe that, as Pringle was saying, we really all are there to serve the patient. And I really do believe that. But sometimes it just gets lost in translation.
Totally. I think always keeping the patient at the center of the conversation is the right way to go about things, because usually you can find agreeances instead of, have you read your own position statement on this?
I think as surgeons, we have to take up this task. I think if we don't, it'll be left to anesthesiologists who don't know patients very well, meeting them often on the day of surgery, maybe in pre-op clinic. And that's just not fair to them. I think when we, especially in instances when we have built a relationship with our patients, then we need to communicate about these things and also with other team members.
I just wanted to interject another component of this, which does have to do with being measured on outcomes and the pressure I think that surgeons and anesthesiologists are under to have what is characteristically thought of as a good outcome. So is it possible that a surgeon or an anesthesiologist would consider that they're taking a patient with a serious comorbidity whose life expectancy is not thought to be more than a year for a palliative procedure, and they die in the act of performing that procedure sometime thereafter within the hospitalization as a good outcome? And, you know, both there's some governmental issues overriding post-operative outcomes, institutional, cultural, specialty-based thoughts about that. And I think the culture of what is perceived to be a good outcome and how we all strive to adhere to that needs a little bit of liberalization before we can feel comfortable working for patients who have limited life expectancy but could actually benefit from something palliative, but might succumb in the process, but that's their decision.
And I think, Prinkle, you bring up a really good point that I think would help surgeons as they wrestle with these things. But, you know, a lot of the work that we do in surgery is still considered palliative. And I think with that mindset, it makes it a little bit easier to think about these challenging issues and how we fit in.
Thank you so much, you guys. As we're wrapping up, is there anything else any of you would like to add?
I just want to say thank you, Red, for your tremendous effort in starting the Surgical Palliative Care podcast. I've really enjoyed listening to your episodes and look forward to more. So thank you for inviting me and to participate in this one. And thank you for starting this.
I was going to thank Sarah for her editorial skills.
Yeah, Sarah, that was a great issue, and I will definitely put a link in the show notes to the American Medical Association Ethics Journal. It's incredible. And I just want to thank all of you very busy women for taking the time out. I'm glad all of our schedules aligned. It was really a joy to talk to you about a subject that I feel so passionate about and hope that more surgeons will continue to think about. So thanks so much, you guys.
Take care.
All right.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter at SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the Surgical Palliative Care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.